From the Adult Swim headquarters at William Street, this is Matt Harrigan with the Adult Swim podcast. Today we're talking to Jeff Grant, who runs research for Adult Swim. What does that mean? Well, we'll find out. Jeff, how's your health?
It's pretty good.
You have any flaws in your body?
I just came off of finding out that I had heel spurs on both feet, and I still ran the Peachtree.
What was your time?
I was, I think, 53:27.
Wow, pretty good.
It was all right.
Is that good? I don't know. I just said that to be
it's
nice.
It's not my fastest. It's not my slowest, so I was happy.
And
did
you train for it?
I typically run about 5 miles every other day,
yeah.
And on weekends I do 8, so this is fine.
What are you running from?
That's the question, isn't it? I don't know. I run to run. Obviously, I run to hurt myself ultimately.
Feel like your body's falling apart?
You know, sometimes it does feel that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us what your job is.
So I am Senior Vice President of Research and Insights for Cartoon Network, Adult Swim, and Boomerang. So I have two teams that report into me, one of them here at William Street, the other one across the street at Techwood. We test all of the pilots that go on air. We analyze all the Nielsen ratings. We do all of the primary research for the brand and show awareness tracking and promo testing. We do research in support of pretty much every single department that we have in the division, whether it's, you know, marketing or consumer products or digital and mobile. I kind of like to say that we're sort of the catcher on the baseball team, where we're in every play, you know, from one degree to another, providing the support and information that the division needs to do business.
So walk us through the testing of a pilot, how that would work. Explain that to somebody who might not know anything about it.
Sure. Well, you can do it a couple of different ways. The major way that we do it, there's a vendor that we use out in Hollywood, and basically it's a theater. And they recruit about 50 or so people that come in, and we give them a screener to figure out the age range and what type of person that we want coming in, a mix of, I don't know, you want a 50-50 split of male, females, you know, ethnicity, whatever, household income, whatever it is, if they watch Adult Swim or not. What they'll do is they'll come in, fill out a little questionnaire, watch the show, fill something out afterwards. And then, while the show is on and they're watching it, we're watching them through the two-way glass watch the show. And they each have dials. And while they're watching it, they can turn the dial up or down to see, to indicate basically how they feel about what they're seeing about the given episode at any time. So afterwards, they'll fill the fuller questionnaire out about scenes or characters or you know, different aspects of what it is that they just saw. And then we choose a variety of different people to stay afterwards and do some focus groups and talk about what it is that they just saw to kind of get some color to the questionnaire that they filled out.
And they get paid.
They do. They are incentivized, for sure.
Well, how much do they get paid?
It depends. I don't exactly know what the going rate is right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, you're, you know, bringing people in to have their, we're taking up their time, and they're doing a job for us. So
does the data determine whether or not a show moves forward?
That's a tricky question. What I like to say is that there are a lot of people that misunderstand how to use show testing. The show testing is not going to tell you if you have a hit on your hands, but it will tell you in a lot of cases whether you have something materially wrong. And you also have to keep in mind that they're in many cases watching only one episode of the show. So, you know, I know that there was that story about how Seinfeld tested horribly. I mean, I've never seen the report, so I don't know what exactly was said, and I don't know which episode they tested. You know, we test pretty much every pilot, I think, that comes through here. We were actually doing some testing a couple weeks ago. for a couple of anime shows and some new stuff that's coming down the pike. So it's always interesting to see what the feedback is. And you can tell, you know, one of the questions in the questionnaire is where the show is best suited. And you get the option of Adult Swim or Comedy Central or something like that. And you can tell right away where people are thinking the best place is for that given show.
So in your experience, does it correlate to success, high performing?
No, and it's not intended to.
Mm-hmm.
I think...
or just coincidentally, anecdotally,
it gives you a peek under the hood. And, if there's an indication that a character or something is not working, it's something that you can go back and tinker with.
So looking back over, how many years have you been doing this?
Well... April 25th was my 23rd anniversary at Turner, but I've been associated with Cartoon Network since 99.
So do you see patterns in data-based decision-making versus sort of taste-based, or is it a combination? What's your
I think it's a combination
thought
of
on that.
It's a combination of the two for sure. But you also have to keep in mind that there's an expectation of the kind of show for Adult Swim that we would put on the air. I don't know whether people like quirky or edgy or whatever the description is, but I think that the consumers, when they come in and watch the show for the test, they kind of have that in the back of their head. And if it's something that's kind of out there, I think we get a bit more latitude, I think, for some of the, far out there programs.
Have you seen sometimes shows just get absolutely killed in a focus group?
Oh, yeah.
And do they disappear?
I have seen that, sure.
Based on a focus group reaction?
Based on focus group reaction, for sure.
Everyone hates it. It's dead.
Well, think about this. You know, for a lot of the stuff that we have, it's animated. And, you know, you've been involved in animated programming yourself. And how far down the line you have to be in the animation process before you have something... to show. So in some cases, we might have a couple of episodes already, you know, in progress. So, you know, sometimes we will run those regardless. I think live action is probably a little bit of a different story where we'll get a pilot and take a look at it. And it will be just that one episode where we could either go back and say, hey, these things, you know, tweak this or do that, or just see completely that the thing is not working.
So you've been here forever. Walk us through your arrival.
Well, I brought some. I actually brought some show and tell.
Oh, okay.
Because this is a visual.
Hard to do that in a podcast.
This is a visual medium, right?
Yeah.
Here, but I will show you what I brought with me.
Okay.
That is the first, if not one of the first.
Jeff handing me a document.
Yes.
Stapled document, several pages.
That I've had in my files for years, dated Halloween of 2000. And it is the marketing plan for what was then called the parental block.
Wow, that's a... That was the original title. That went away.
That went away quick. Well, can you imagine?
Parental block.
How dated that term?
Right. Was it a pun on cable operators being able to block channels?
Yeah. Didn't Tipper Gore have something to do with that then?
Wow. So this is dated, Halloween 2000.
Right. And it says that the launch is April 1st of the following year. Aqua Teen, I believe, premiered in December of 2000. So it came on air, or the show's at least launched before the date specified on that particular marketing document.
Right. Wow, that's wild.
Yeah.
So you held on to that?
I did.
You held on to a lot of memorabilia from over the years?
No, this is probably one of the more unique things. I have a couple things from the Cartoon Network side. Like when we launched Teen Titans, the original series, I kept the show Bible for that, because I thought that was kind of cool.
But you saw, why did you hold on to that?
You know what? I don't even think that I realized I had it until much later. And once I realized I had it, I kept it nicely because I figured it was a nice little artifact, little document.
Yeah. It's in good shape.
Yeah, it's very good shape.
So you were here for the dawning of the network and before.
That's right. I started in 99 and we launched CartoonNetwork.com, and then that went ad supported, and then Adult Swim came around because, you know, we were Cartoon Network 24 hours a day back then. And after a while, it gets tough to monetize a part of the day where kids are sleeping. So, right. And we tend to give away a lot of, we do what's called under delivery make goods with the inventory that ran overnight.
Add inventory.
So you're not really making money on that. And then, you know, the people here at Techwood came up with the idea of what ultimately became Adult Swim, and the rest is history. We were on for what was it, 2 nights a week, and then it rolled out and expanded and took over all evening and all through late night.
What did you think when you heard that this was a proposal?
You know, it's a great idea. I mean, it was a win-win all around. It was just a matter, I think, of getting content and putting it in and having it work. But I was on the ad sales side at the time, and just from the people that I spoke to, I mean, it was the more you give them to do and sell, the better. So I know that they were excited and incentivized by that.
So it's interesting. So how many kids, I mean, I'm saying it's interesting because I think I know the answer, but how many kids watch the network at midnight on a Monday night?
So here's the thing. So I one of the things that I did get involved with back when I was in New York on the ad sales side, working on Adult Swim, is that we would do Nielsen analyses, right? And we would see when the numbers came in that kids were still up and watching Adult Swim at 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning. And you look at the numbers and you're like, this can't be right. And one of the problems that we had, obviously, was if you have a high percentage of kids watching, there are certain advertisers that you're not allowed to bring in. So, for instance, we were not allowed to bring in M-rated video games. We were not allowed to bring in R-rated movie advertisers. But a lot of these guys were all just kind of like looking at us, chomping at the bit, wanting to get involved with Adult Swim. They just couldn't do it just because rules with the ESRB and the MPAA precluded them from doing that. So I actually went to Nielsen and I was like, can you help us out here? Because something doesn't sound right. And we ended up doing an analysis of sleepers, I'm using my air quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were able to see is, you know, the way that they're able to track ratings is that in recruited homes, they have the people meter. And one of the downsides to the people meter is that there's usually after about 45 minutes or so, a light that flashes. And you're supposed to hit the remote control that comes with it to tell them that you're still there watching. But if you don't hit the button, nothing happens. And it just continues to roll and measure. So what we said to them is that, you know, if you've got kids in the home, and back then there were a lot of TVs in kids' rooms, it'd be interesting to see the juxtaposition now with the kids that have, you know, tablets and laptops and things instead of the television. But can you look at the people meter and see whether anything changes over the course of the evening? And if it doesn't, you could pretty well assume that a kid had fallen asleep in front of the television, because the people meter reporting would just flatline throughout the entire night. And if you take that out, then what happens to the composition of viewers that you have watching Adult Swim or, you know, late night on the same channel as Cartoon Network? So if a kid fell asleep while they were watching Cartoon Network and then Adult Swim came on and they're out cold. So if you took all of those out, the composition's totally changed to a point where we had met the requirements of both the ESRB and the MPAA, and we got Nielsen to write us a mea culpa letter, for lack of a better term. And once we did that and went to the advertisers, I think what I remember hearing back then in the first week, it was like an incremental $15 million that we got in like video game and movie money, because they were good to go. And
no just, kids.
Yeah. Or at least few enough that legally it allowed them to advertise.
And that opened the floodgates.
For those two categories, for sure. You know, beer and wine, liquor is another issue. And there's other issues with it sharing channel space with the kids network for that.
It seems like it's always been a bit of a burden, right? Sharing channel space with the kids network.
Yeah, totally. You know, over the years, we've had to do research on research. For one, with Adult Swim, how to ask about Adult Swim, because, you know, when we first started, there weren't a lot of people who knew what it was, in the sense that, you know, from a Nielsen standpoint, it's a separate television network. But for the consumer that's watching the network or watching the channel, it flows one into the other.
And one
channel. So it's one channel. Is it a block that runs on Cartoon Network? Is it its own network by itself? So we had to do a lot of that. And, you know, certainly as part of the brand research that we do on both the Cartoon Network and the Adult Swim side is, you know, see the effect, you know, in the case of, like, if we survey parents about Cartoon Network, you know, there occasionally it will come up about Adult Swim, although that's kind of mellowed out a little bit over the years.
In the early days, parents would be up in arms over some of the programming.
Yeah. But, you know, it is what it is. I mean, we basically have the same sort of model as the Nick and Knight, what they do.
Yeah.
Even though I think their programming is arguably a bit milder than what we have on Adult Swim. But I also think Adult Swim is programmed in such a way where some of the dicier stuff is on later at night. So there is a greater separation between that and, you know, Gumball and Teen Titans Go and that kind of thing.
Do you feel like you have to try and differentiate your personal behavior with the behavior of the potential audience?
Absolutely. Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, you know, you run into a lot of people who do kind of armchair research and base that on what their friends and family know. But, you know, especially around here is really tough because, you know, we work in the media business, and it makes it a little bit different than, you know, average American across the country who probably does not consume as much media as we do working in the industry. So I would rather take what's going on from a nationally representative sample than a handful of people who are, you know, work for a media company.
You get a lot of opinions offered your way?
Very many.
Internally?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other side of that argument, though, is, like, if you talk to Lazo, and he, like, I'm not telling tales out of school here, he would probably say that, you know, the people who work here at William Street, and there's a part of this that's absolutely true, they are the audience for Adult Swim. You know, young people within the demographic, and whether they have TV or are streaming it on other types of services, you know, in his mind, it the people who work here and the profile that they represent are very reflective of what he sees as the general audience.
So would you agree with that from your professional, with your background in it? Do you agree?
I prefer not to take, not to give as much weight to the people around me here at work, even though their opinion is important for sure. I'd rather rely on what it is that I can find in the research that we do.
Data.
Mm-hmm.
So the information, the data that you gather informs the program selection and the programming, where in the night
That's correct. So I've got people on my team work with Kim Manning, who was on this podcast a few weeks ago, and work with her and help her realign the schedule if it needs realigning, if there's shows that need to come off or, you know, nights that get to be rearranged in order to maximize the amount of viewership. That's all the analysis that we do. In addition to, and related to this, are the estimates that the team puts together for forecasting the business.
That's got to be very difficult.
It is. You know, we like to look at a couple of years ahead, but any further than that is really kind of tough because you just don't know what's going to happen much further out than that.
What do you think is going to happen? Tell us.
You know, I think...
we'll listen to this in a year and see if you were right.
Well, I think, look, you know, the WarnerMedia has this OTT thing that's coming out that they actually just announced the name for today. And, you know, I think that there is definitely down the road going to be a change in the business model. It has to be. And I think that this OTT product is a step in that direction. You know, part of it is getting all of the content like for the company back, getting the Rick and Morty's, you know, and, you know, WarnerMedia made the whole, or there was a whole announcement about Friends and taking it off of Netflix. You know, this is all the kind of chess moves that are happening to try to make this product successful.
If you could sum it up in a nutshell, what's the current Adult Swim viewer?
The viewer has actually gotten older. They've grown up with the brand in a sense. So we're definitely a little older now than what we were, because the people who joined us when we first started and were, you know, 18 to 24 year olds have in large part stuck with the brand. So, you know, as far as like a target demographic now, I think is closer to an 18 to 49, just because of the broad scope of the people that now watch the network, and have done so over the years. But I would say that we definitely program to that younger end of the age range, because that's basically what Adult Swim is. It's I think it's attitudinal. It's
is it a 30-year-old male living in Cleveland?
I don't know if it's that specific, but we've definitely gotten to be a bit more equally balanced between male and female over the years. Where, you know, cartoon skews definitely more boy, Adult Swim has been balancing out, which is good to see.
Tell us about your relationship with the New York Times crossword puzzle.
It goes back a long ways. I've been doing the crossword for probably over 30 years, at least. My grandmother on my dad's side was a big New York Times crossword puzzle fan, and my mom is a big fan of the puzzle. So I kind of came by it naturally. So I don't know that I don't think I've missed one. I actually juggle a lot of them.
You do it every day.
I do the New York Times every day. I do the Nation Cryptic when that comes in, which is usually every other week. But then there are some stretches during the year where it's every week. So I have to keep an eye out for that. And then on Fridays, the Wall Street Journal delivers its specialty puzzle for Saturday.
Huh.
So that's where when I came on the streams and took the moniker of Eugene T. Maleska.
Yeah, who's that?
He was the New York Times crossword puzzle editor back in the 1970s, I think, and maybe even the early 80s. And it was funny because, when I first got on the chat and started to follow, what was then, I think, Dave and the Crossword Guys or whatever it was being called then, I kind of came off as like a WWE villain, because everybody thought that I was cheating, with the answers in the puzzle. But that wasn't the case. And, I finally like popped my head into the, well, you guys were back in the conference room back then. And I saw Max and Dave for the first time and basically revealed myself to be Eugene T. Maleska.
Oh.
And they asked me to come on the show that day.
You've been on, you were an early advocate of the streams.
Very much so. I think it's a big innovation that we're doing here. I mean, think about it. There's really no other network that's doing this.
What appeals to you about the streams?
I think what appeals to me about the streams, other than the whole crossword puzzle aspect of Blood Feast, is the fact that, you know, where this kind of crosses in with my work and my sort of personal shtick is the whole fandom element of it. Because when I get into things that I like, I get into them deeply, crosswords being one of them. I've been an avid comic book collector for a gazillion years. and things like that, that I get into wholeheartedly. And at the same time, from a work standpoint, we've done a lot of research on generational aspects of fandom. So I like to think that I, you know, walk the walk as well as talk the talk.
So you're a fan.
I am a fan. I'm a fan. And look, I don't think I'd be here as long as I have been if I wasn't. Yeah, I've worked at two companies, this one, and I was at CBS for 7.5 years prior to Turner.
You worked with some famous people there. Dan Rather?
I did. Mike Wallace.
Wow.
I use the term worked with them loosely.
Uh-huh. Near them.
Well, I was in Standards and Practices at one point, which was a job that I could not stand.
I mean, how tough was that with Dan Rather and Mike Wallace? Were they always saying, fuck off?
The Mike Wallace thing was a time where the National Enquirer was reporting that he had gotten in some car accident or something. And my phone rang one day and it was him. How he found out that I was the one reviewing that particular ad, I have no idea. But basically he called and very sternly told me that that commercial was not going to go on the air for the National Enquirer. And at that point, I had to get my boss involved. But I actually did deal with personally because I had to do in the job before Standards and Practices, I was with CBS News Advertising and Promotion. And part of my job was negotiating the affiliate promos that we would do after CBS This Morning or after the CBS Evening News. And, you know, occasionally you'd have anchors that come in from Roanoke or something and want to sit at the desk next to Dan, and they'd have scripts already. And, you know, you'd have to have everything booked. And I know the first time I did it, I definitely screwed up, and Dan was so pissed that he actually would not come out of his office.
Wow. Threw a temper tantrum.
He did throw a tantrum.
Because of something you did.
Because of something I did.
Oh, that's kind of cool to have that in your bank. So what would you have done? What did you almost do besides this job?
Well, you know, I talk at NYU once a term. And one of the things that I say to the students there is that when I was in college as an undergraduate at Michigan, you know, I wish there was someone like me who came in and talked about the different areas of media that you can get into. Because when I was at Michigan and you're doing communication or studying TV or whatever it is, I would say probably 98% of the people that were in those classes, all they thought about was production. And I did too. And that's what I got into at first. But it was news, and I never really liked news all that much. You know, there was a point where my boss gave me and my fellow PA, we had pagers, because this was like back in the Stone Age. And it's all pre-9/11. And I'm on a plane heading back to Michigan, actually, for homecoming. And the pager goes off on the plane. So I hop off the plane. I run to a payphone. You know, I've got my backpack. And, you know, very quickly, like, calling my boss, what's the problem, you know, deal with whatever it is. And I realize I'm late and I'm booking out. And no sooner do I step outside, I had two hands on each shoulder, and they were federal drug enforcement agents that had profiled me since I'd gotten off the plane, because they saw a single guy traveling from New York to Detroit with a pager and a backpack in a big hurry, stopping off to go and make a very quick phone call at the payphone. So fortunately, my boss had given me CBS News credentials. So I was able to at least talk my way out of getting stopped by the federal drug enforcement agents.
So were you holding?
Not that time, no. The job was like that a lot. And like, if you got called late night, you know, you'd have to be in at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to make sure you got promos on the air before CBS This Morning. For Noriega, I was in the building for probably, I don't know, about 2.5 days. I wasn't able to leave because we had to follow him and wherever he was going and constantly getting footage and all that. But news just killed me, and I had to get out. So
now you're in the opposite.
Yeah.
avid comic book collector. Do you collect other things besides comic books?
No, that's
just comic books.
Yeah, my collection I've had cooking since probably I was 7 years old. At least that's how far back my earliest personal issues.
Were you actively collecting mm-hmm. at seven? Like you knew that you were collecting these,
yes.
or that you weren't just a fan of them?
Yes,
you had them.
My grandparents would go down to Florida, and there was a comic book store down there. I would give them a list of things that I was looking for, and to this day, those issues are. I have the complete run of the original Justice League of America, starting I think it was 1962, 63. So I have that whole first run. I've got the complete run of Marvel Team Up. That was, you know, a lot of issues that they got me back then, and I've filled that out over the years. But I've also part of my collection is starting to get I have a big Batgirl collection, like the first 20 appearances of Batgirl, first 20 of Silver Surfer, The Punisher. I know I'm missing some other stuff, but. Yeah, and I've got some random key issues of things like the first Avengers and first Daredevil, and it runs the gauntlet. Actually, you know what? No, there is another collection that I have on my blog, my selfies.
Yeah, your selfies.
I've stopped that, though. I've slowed down and started to stop.
So explain what this is.
So it kind of started as a goof, and it kind of continued to be a goof. But ultimately, I have a blog, and on it, I have about 400 items. I feel as though I've lived kind of sort of a Forrest Gumpian type of life, where I've been at places where people are. And I have definitely gotten the sense that over the years that things have attitudes have changed about doing selfies and things. So I've kind of set on the collection the way it is, and I'm happy. I have a lot of
it's concluded,
more or less. Yes.
Come on, there's something. You're gonna get another one.
The recent one I got
is missing.
there's a lot that are missing, but the recent one that I got was Jason Bateman, who was here for a TV Academy event. But that was I would say different than what my normal hunt is like.
What are your highlights?
Oh God. There's just so many. It's like trying to, I posted one to Instagram today of me and Tom Hanks, cause today's his 63rd birthday.
How did you get a picture with Tom Hanks?
At the Emmys 1 year. I've been to the Emmys about 5 or 6 times, and that's shooting fish in a barrel. You know, people are at a party and kind of happy and whatever.
Who has said no to you?
Quite a few. Chris Noth has said no. Maggie Gyllenhaal, Gina Davis. I was swinging for the fences for some of those. But at the same time, you know, I've got Al Pacino. I've got Matt Damon. I've got a bunch of people.
Have you gone back to people who said no and tried again?
No, my more recent, as they've started to say no. So say I would be at the Emmys or something, I'd have the ticket with me. So Lawrence Fishburne was a good example of someone who was super cool. And we were talking and I asked and he said very politely no. And I was like, would you please then, could you sign my ticket? He was like, absolutely, totally happy to do it.
Wow.
So I actually have my most recent Emmy ticket has Laura Dern, Lawrence Fishburne, George R. R. Martin, and Larry David. How's that for an eclectic mix?
Yeah, that's one of everybody.
So, yeah, it's a vast collection. Anybody who wants to see my blog, it's, I believe, on my Twitter or my Instagram. It's easily gotten to. It's entertaining. It's a rabbit hole.
Jeff Grant, thanks for coming on.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
Music from this episode is a song called Living in America from the album Sun Bronze Greek Gods by Dom. Be sure to visit adultswim.com/podcast for links to some of the things Jeff and I were just talking about. As always, we'd love to hear from you. adultswimpodcast@gmail.com. Send me maybe you have a request, a criticism. You want to know when Rick and Morty's coming back? And thank you, the listener, for listening.